Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How can farmers working in some of the world's harshest growing conditions glean the most from their land while protecting it at the same time? An innovative approach to land management and water conservation is giving small villages in India greater control over their crops and greater economic and food security than their ancestors could have dreamed. New York Times Magazine contributing writer Sarah Corbett explains in her new article for the November 2009 issue of National Geographic Magazine. The piece is called A Harvest of Water. Sarah, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris.
Can you start by talking to us about the difference in conditions between the monsoon season in India and the rest of the year?
Sure. Most of India, most of agricultural India is dependent on the southeast monsoon, which sweeps across Asia, usually beginning in about June and wrapping up in September. And so what you see, if you go to India during the dry season, and between January and May, is brown. You see a crisp, hot, cloudless place. And you also meet a lot of farmers who are waiting for rain. What happens when the monsoon comes is traditionally it has come and dumped three-quarters of the annual rainfall onto the land in just a span of about 10 to 12 weeks. So when the rain comes, it comes fast and furious, which puts farmers in a tricky position of needing to use that rain to sustain themselves through the year.
Yeah, because in some places, groundwater supplies are so tapped out during the dry season that even drinking water is trucked in.
Yes, and what's interesting is if you travel through rural India during the dry season, the roads are packed with people. I mean, just jam-packed. You could be out in the middle of nowhere, and you see two things. You see tanker trucks filled with water, and what they're doing is distributing water from places that have water to these parched villages. You know, if you think about it, it's not cost-effective, it's not environmentally friendly, but you see tons and tons of water being moved around the countryside. And then the other thing you see is trucks and bullock carts filled with migrant laborers, people mostly who tend to be farmers, who are displaced off their land because their land isn't producing and are forced to go work on road crews or on government projects or in farms that in places that do have water. So you see these two things. You see a lot of movement and, you know, arguably a lot of wasted resources, all because the water is not being distributed. And I should add that the water that's going in tanker trucks is not going to support agriculture. It's just going to give people their daily water needs, drinking water, washing, things like that.
And for people who aren't familiar with the situation, we hear that the monsoons come without fail every year, but it's the timing of them quite precisely that turns out to be an exceptionally risky proposition for farmers.
Right. It's interesting. When I first went to India and started talking to farmers in these rural areas, I would say, well, when will you put your seeds in? Because it's a science for them. It's something that they've been doing for generations. And they would say, well, the monsoon is coming on June 10th, and so we're going to put in our seeds on May 30th, something like that. And what they based it on traditionally was they have, it's kind of a Hindu version of a farmer's almanac, and it's based on the constellations. And so year to year, a new almanac would come out, and it would say when, you know, that the monsoon arrives on the third day of Rohini, which is a certain constellation. And so they put their seeds in the ground ahead of that, and, you know, evidently it had worked for generations, and everybody was very, you know, set in their ways. But what they were telling me, the farmers I met, was that year after year, it was becoming less and less reliable. And it's kind of hard to underestimate the cost of this to them, because these are mostly subsistence-level farmers. And so they put their seeds in the ground and start waiting for the rain. And if, you know, the monsoon arrived 1 week late, 2 weeks late, or the season I was there, it was 3.5 weeks late, the seeds broil in the ground. The temperatures are way up over 100 degrees every day. And so it's a whole crop that's lost for people, which is, you know, an entire season's worth of food. So what they were finding was that the monsoon, which, yes, we all think of as kind of the most reliable weather system, that the rains come and they've always come and this is how it's always been, slowly they're sensing some disruption. And scientists, meteorologists, are just beginning to confirm this. What they found is that the total amount of rainfall over India hasn't changed year to year. So it was a bit of a mystery for a while, because they would look at the rain gauges and say, oh, we got the same amount last year as the year before, so why is everybody feeling so distressed? But what they found when they kind of parsed the data a bit was that the total number of rainy days in the season was diminishing, which means that when the rain came, a lot more rain would fall really quickly. And for farmers, this wasn't good news. You know, so they could get a month's worth of rain in 2 days, and suddenly that would wash away any seedlings or seeds. It causes erosion. It causes flooding. So it's becoming a bit of a lose-lose proposition for farmers.
Yeah, when you talk about seeds and seedlings being washed away, this is the other problem. They can't simply wait until the day the rain begins to fall and run out there in the rain, because that's too late.
Right, exactly. They need, you know, every crop is slightly different, but, you know, most of the farmers I met were living on millet primarily, and millet had to go in the ground and sort of germinate a little bit in order to grow optimally. It was a very precise season. Also, that farmers would hope that they could often get a second growing crop out of the monsoon season. So, you know, if you only have 12 weeks to produce most of your crops, you try to maximize every single day, which means starting your seeds ahead of time.
And so that puts these farmers not only at risk, obviously, for hunger and for poverty, but the suicide rate in hard-hit areas has been alarmingly high in the past few years.
It has. It's something that's made headlines around the world. Farmer suicides in Maharashtra, which is the state that I focused on, I believe they've tripled in the last decade, and it's become something of an epidemic. And when you look at it more closely, it's a very complex situation. Part of it is social. Part of it depends on the crops. Most of the suicides tend to come from cotton farmers, and that's they're depending on subsidies. There are a lot of issues that are connected to water, but also not connected to water with those suicides. But the big thing that I saw was that the farmers, year to year, when you have a crop fail, you go into debt, and you know they would then borrow money to buy the next year's seeds, to buy fertilizers, sometimes to rent animals to pull the plows if they didn't own their own livestock, and then if you have a second failure, you know, then the money lending in India, it's not like it is here. It's pretty brutal, and it would often drive farmers to suicide.
Because essentially, I guess after two bad seasons, there's almost no recovery.
Yeah, I mean, I saw a lot of really sad stories, I have to say. I mean, once a family falls into debt, it's so unlikely that even a good monsoon season is going to give you, you know, a bumper crop. Or if you're having a good monsoon season, everybody around you is having one too. So food prices are low, you know, so that, yeah, it's not an easy thing to climb out of for an Indian farmer.
Journalist Sarah Corbett is my guest. Her new article, A Harvest of Water, appears in the current issue of National Geographic magazine. So another problem, Sarah, is that during the times when there is abundant water, during these months of monsoon, a large amount of it ultimately is lost as runoff. How does the natural state of the land contribute to that problem?
Well, there are a couple of things that contribute to the issue. One is just poor land use practices that have grown up over generations in that part of India and really around the world. When people are overusing their land, when they are cutting a lot of trees for firewood, you know, every house I visited in rural India, all the cooking was done on firewood. You know, the women would go out and cut trees and then burn the wood inside their homes. So this would dry out the land. You know, a lot of the valleys you'd go to were just absolutely parched. They looked not quite like desert, but sort of pre-desert conditions, because there was just no ground cover. And then erosion is high. And so when the rain comes, the soil is cracked and denuded, and it will just run right away. And so desperate places got a lot more desperate quickly if they didn't take care of their land. The other issue was grazing. People, if you have a little bit of money there, the first thing you do is invest in a cow or a pair of oxen to plow, or sheep sheep or goats, and you know, the grazing again would take away the greenery of the land, and over time you would just see what really looked like a wasteland, and people trying to farm this land, it was very obvious why it wasn't working.
So talk about the Watershed Organization Trust and how it operates.
Well, so I focused on this organization, Watershed Organization Trust, and they're a really interesting non-governmental organization. They are focused on helping small villages reclaim their own watersheds. And this is a lot different than some of the other approaches that we've seen to water use management in India. Most of them have been led by the government. They've involved building big dams, or there's sort of a top-down approach to aid, like we're going to come in and fix your watershed, and then we'll leave, and hopefully that will make it better. But the way this organization works is they identify villages that have a lot of need, and the first thing they do is have a meeting, and they say to the village, if you want our help, we need your full partnership, and that means that you need to prove to us that you're willing to work on your own watershed and also to sustain it. This might seem like a simple thing, but it's really not, because you're talking about people who have to work very, very hard for what little they have. Many of the people I met, the families were eating one meal a day. They had no savings. Their kids weren't in school because they put all their energy into trying to cultivate their land. So what this organization does is says to a village, you all need to contribute free labor to our project, which that alone is a big proposal. They say you need to, as a group, come together and form a village watershed council. On this council, there have to be women, which, again, in India is not something you see very often, particularly in rural farming villages, the representation of women in decision-making bodies. You have to ban the cutting of live trees for firewood, which, you know, as I mentioned, that's a big, big deal, especially for the women of the village. They ask that villagers agree to tether their livestock for a year and then bring them fodder instead of letting them graze over the land. So they're big sacrifices, and it seems kind of counterintuitive to the farmers when this is first proposed. But one of the other things they do is they will take the villagers who are considering this plan, and they will put them in a couple of trucks or a school bus, and they will drive them to a village that has already undergone this transition, that has already worked to bring back its watershed. And they will show them what a green village looks like. And I tell you, it's the most convincing thing. The people I spoke to, once they saw what it looks like, what the best case scenario could be, you know, people being able to grow two, sometimes three crops a year, wells being filled during the dry season, no tanker trucks having to bring drinking water, and, you know, improved livelihoods all around, they were pretty sold on it. Technically, what redeveloping a watershed is you know, it's kind of drawing on this age-old wisdom about terracing the landscape, basically taking the rainwater when it falls and preparing the land better to catch that rainwater and sink it deeper into the ground so that the soil stays moist longer, so runoff is reduced, erosion is reduced. So it's a lot of digging, frankly. It's a lot of work with a pickaxe, and it's not easy work. But once that watershed is revived, the effects are really profound and pretty quick, too.
Sarah Corbett is my guest. Her new article, A Harvest of Water, appears in the current issue of National Geographic magazine. We'll resume the conversation in a moment and invite you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is New York Times Magazine contributing writer Sarah Corbett. Her new article in National Geographic Magazine, the November 2009 issue, is called A Harvest of Water. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. The other thing, Sarah, that this requires that is not necessarily easily achieved is getting neighbors to set aside animosities that in some cases they've held for decades.
Right. I saw this firsthand. When I went to India for National Geographic, I wanted to seek out a village that was kind of in transition, you know, that had started watershed redevelopment but hadn't finished it yet, so I could see what it looked like. And so I ended up focusing on this little village of about 300-400 people called Satitiwadi. And Satitiwadi sits at the bottom of a valley about 100 miles northeast of Mumbai. And it's a tribal village. It's native people who were formerly nomads. And so I think they'd only been there about 2 to 3 generations. And you know, it was, as I was describing earlier, it was a typical place in that it was, the land had been worked over, the trees were gone. It was kind of a godforsaken place. Most of the people there are what you think about when you think of the base of the economic pyramid. They're dollar-a-day subsistence-level farmers. And Satitiwadi had been settled, basically, by two men about 100 years ago, one whose last name was Kale and one whose last name was Pawar. Both had been shepherds from tribal groups, and they had sort of wandered into this valley and kind of started homesteading there. And over the years, the Pawars and the Kales had reproduced and started farming. And the one thing that the older people in the village would say was that when they were children, the village had actually been very rich in vegetation. And, you know, they sort of remembered it as being a very fertile place. And nobody knows why, but at some point, the Kales and the Pawars stopped getting along, and they had all been kind of living together, and about 40 years ago, the Kales sort of picked up and moved to the other side of the valley. And so when I got there, you had these two subgroups. You know, it was sort of the Hatfields and the McCoys living, trying to share this valley that had been so denuded and overused that it was barely producing anything. You know, they were still only separated by a couple of hundred yards, but they barely spoke to each other. They didn't attend each other's weddings. And when the Kales wanted to go worship the village goddess who lived over in the Pawar side of the valley, the goddess is like a stone idol living inside a temple, they would sort of march through the Pawar settlement and go to the temple without really saying hello. So it was definitely a bit of a tense situation. They all had a sense of humor about it. I love the Pawar family wouldn't refer to the Kale family by name. They just call them the fed-up people. And they would say, I'd say, oh, you know, where is this meeting happening about the watershed? And they'd say, oh, it's over in fed-up town. And fed-up town was, you know, over in the Kale settlement. But what was interesting was when I got there, they were in their third year of a three-year watershed redevelopment program. And because WOTR, the nonprofit that I wrote about, because they required this harmony, because they said you have to come together and you have to work side by side to bring back your watershed. You have to make decisions as a group about your watershed. You have to administer funds all together. You know, it was sort of this forced diplomacy between the two sides of the village. It was starting to work. And life was improving for people, and I think that was then leading to the harmony. You know, if I were to speculate about why the Kales and the Pawars stopped getting along, it probably had to do with their competition for resources. You know, it's sort of an interesting paradigm of what happens to all of us when we're starved for resources. You get a lot less neighborly. And so I think what they realized was actually working together, they had a lot of power to control what happened when the rain came from the sky. And if you visit Satitiwadi now, I was there most recently last winter, And it was the dry season. It was the beginning of the dry season, but they had water in their wells. For the first time in years, they had a little bit of extra water in their wells. They were still harvesting. They were harvesting tomatoes in January, which was something that had never happened to them before. And they were then able to take the tomatoes were a cash crop. You know, they were feeding their families well enough that they could then go to the local market a few towns over and sell those tomatoes for a profit. People were starting to have bank accounts. And again, this is really the first time any of this had happened in this village. You know, these are the poorest of the poor in a country, you know, where one out of three people goes hungry. I mean, it's pretty profound to see what improving their access to water and improving their ability to use what little resources they had as a community, what it was doing for their lives.
Sarah Corbett is my guest. Her article, A Harvest of Water, appears in the current issue of National Geographic. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find GP in Dallas. Hi, GP. Hello, GP. Are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Hi. Go ahead, please.
I couldn't. Whatever I spoke was only with you, is it? I couldn't talk to Sarah or...
You're talking to Chris, and Sarah's on the line as well. Do you have a question?
No, I just wanted to add on to what was commented earlier, because I have been from the place, I have seen everything that was described, and I could connect it very well. And I was just reading the article a few minutes back, and I could talk to the Sarah, so it was good. So I just called out.
Oh, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Sarah, have you heard from a lot of people who sort of grew up in those circumstances and have moved on and could relate to the difference it might have made in the places where they lived?
Certainly not in the U.S. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's wonderful to hear from somebody. I think that anybody who is from India or has spent time in India or really in any part of the developing world where water is an issue, and it's a tremendous geographical area we're talking about, I think they recognize what water scarcity, the kind of deprivations that come with water scarcity, for sure. And I think that when somebody is lucky enough to move from a place where water is a scarce resource to where water is a ready resource, you know, it does throw into high relief kind of the interconnectedness of things. One thing that really was profound for me was seeing what happened to the lives of children when a watershed was redeveloped. I traveled all around a certain area of Maharashtra and talked to people who had no watershed redevelopment, to villages where they were underway and villages where it was completed. And in some of the villages that had successfully worked with the community to bring back the water and sort of improve their livelihoods, the literacy rates among children went from 5% to 70%.
Wow.
In the village. Children's health improved vastly because, you know, the first thing that would happen when a crop failed is people would cut back. You know, they'd take out one meal a day or two meals a day, and, you know, they were eating very, very little in many places, and this was directly connected to the rain. Another thing that I noticed, that photographer Lindsay Adario and I, we crashed a wedding in a village in this area we were writing about, I was writing about. And so we went to, you know, and as Indian weddings are kind of famous for being big affairs and lasting many days and you know, really beautiful traditions and dancing and huge communal events, hundreds of people. But what we were seeing was the wedding we went to was a 14-year-old girl being married to a 17-year-old boy. And as we started to talk to people, the reason, I mean, primarily the reason they were being married was so that they could go work in the sugarcane fields. That a girl was an economic liability to a family before she was married. And once she was married, sugarcane is a big industry. And ironically, it's a very water-intensive industry in Maharashtra. So you have these sort of water-starved farms, and then you have these irrigated areas with these big sugar cane fields and then sugar mills. And people who work in sugar cane fields work as a team, usually a male-female team, where the man will go and cut cane all day, and it's very grueling work. And then the women gather, equally grueling, gather and bundle the cane and load it into carts. And so a man on his own or a woman on her own can't work very well in the sugarcane fields. And one of the things that we heard was that water scarcity would impel these families to get their children married as quickly as possible so that they could then start contributing economically to the family. And that it was a little alarming to see it. And in the villages where watershed redevelopment had been successful, there were two things happening. Women had more power. Women, they would say, you know, previously had a visitor like me come to a village, they wouldn't have left their houses. They would tell me that we wouldn't have even served you tea. We would have made the tea, and our husbands would have served it to you. But because watershed development requires participation of women and their decision making, they suddenly had a lot more power. And one of the things that they were fighting was early marriage. They were insisting that their daughters be 17, 18 years old before they're married, which is a pretty radical change for that part of the world.
Well, and it's so interesting because it sounds, Sarah, like it came not a moment too soon for these women. These were not people who didn't want to have this kind of liberation. They were just waiting for something to make it possible.
It seems like it, and it's really wonderful to see the decisions that specifically the women were making once they had a little bit of power and also a little bit of income. One of the things that's going on across India is women are organizing themselves into savings groups. And so, for example, in Satichiwadi, the village I was in, there were three or four savings groups for women, and they would meet once a month. And you would go, and they'd meet at one of the women's houses, and generally they had about 15 members per savings group. And each of the women would bring 100 rupees, and 100 rupees is about $2, and contribute it to the pot every single month. And they had a secretary and a ledger, and they would write who had contributed what. And then anytime a woman in the group had any need, and, you know, need could be needing fertilizer, paying to take a sick child to the doctor, buying supplies, paying for a wedding, the group would provide her with a low interest loan. And so it was really interesting to watch women having economic power. And some of the things they did, they were buying solar lights for their houses. And again, these are places, they're not off the grid, but they only have electricity about 4 hours per day. And sometimes it's based on a government system, so sometimes it's from 10 to 2 in the afternoon, and it didn't do them any good. So they were buying solar lights. They were buying smokeless cookers so that they were not so reliant on firewood. If you've ever sat inside of a mud house with somebody who's got a big fire going, you start coughing, and you see respiratory problems among children. And the women were taking their money and using it to buy
smokeless cookers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they were making changes. In another village I went to, the women had banded together and banned the sale of alcohol in the village. They had decided that the alcohol was causing too many problems, and so they just literally drove the liquor store owner out of town. The ones I met were really enjoying their newfound power. I went to a meeting of one of these groups one night, and they sat in this little home, and a lot of their children were with them, and they went through their business of collecting the money, and then they started singing songs. And somebody started translating the songs for me, and it dawned on me that they were a little bit like, kind of like what a rugby team sings. You know, they were sort of these women's fight songs about don't let your husband do this, and be sure that you take your child to the doctor. And, you know, they were fully realizing their own power, and I think that was a very new thing.
Sarah Corbett is my guest. We're talking about her article, A Harvest of Water, in the current issue of National Geographic. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org, and that's where we hear from Stephen, who writes, you said that as part of the agreement, a willing community must agree to make changes, including agreeing not to cut trees for firework. Are there alternate processes suggested for these candidate communities, or do they have to agree without knowing how they will meet the requirements?
That's a great question. There are two parts to that. I mean, the smokeless cookers I was just describing, the Watershed Organization Trust offers them at a discount to people participating in this project. They try to make it easier for women to become less reliant on firewood. They also, the ban is on cutting whole trees, so you can still, I think, cut the branches off trees or gather firewood that's fallen on the ground. Like all the concessions these communities had to make, there was certainly an inconvenience attached to it. So the women in Satitiwati, for example, they had to hike pretty far to go get their firewood, and I think initially there was some resentment toward that, but once they started seeing the benefits, and it's pretty remarkable how quickly the benefits, they said that within one season they were starting to notice a difference in their land and the productivity of the land and their access to water. You know, so that gets people to buy in a little more quickly. I don't want to romanticize it. I mean, I think it's a hard step for villages to take, and there were a number of villages who would embark on this journey and not make it. You know, who couldn't find the harmony to work together or couldn't find consensus among the villagers about what's, you know, which sacrifices are worth making for these longer-term benefits. So it's definitely, you know, it's really nice to be writing about a solution, and especially kind of this locally based solution to a problem that's really kind of a global problem. But it doesn't mean it's easy. It doesn't mean it's successful in every instance. And so there's a lot of room for growth there.
How much does it cost for a village to do this? And I know that the Watershed Organization Trust is an NGO, but obviously, have they sort of figured out how much per village approximately needs to be invested?
Yes and no. I mean, they do have per village costs, but the villages really vary in terms of the number of people living there and also the landscape. Mm-hmm. You know, if a village has a nice micro watershed with a good slope and a clear drainage area, my understanding is the work is cheaper. But as I recall, Satitiwati, I believe the total cost for a 3-year watershed program there was about $60,000. Hmm. And the best way I can put that into perspective is that I one day went and visited another village called Kondermal, which was maybe about half an hour's drive from Satitiwati.
You know, Sarah, I'm so sorry to stop you right there, but we need to
sure.
take a break. We'll resume the story in just a moment. Sarah Corbett is with us. If you would like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Sarah Corbett. She's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. Her newest article in National Geographic Magazine is called A Harvest of Water. It's in the November issue. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Sarah, before the break, you were trying to give us some perspective on the $60,000 price tag for Satitiwati in doing this 3-year water development program, and you were about to tell us about another village.
Right. So I visited a village called Kondermal, which was similar to Satitiwati, a bit bigger, but the same problems in terms of having their wells going dry, having very poorly productive agricultural efforts. And they pointed out there was a river down in the bottom of the valley, and a well-known international development outfit had paid $500,000 to install a pipeline to pump water several miles uphill to this village. And apparently it had worked for about 90 days, the villagers said, and then just stopped working. And when I was there, you know, there were miles of pipeline just kind of rusting out and not working. And that was $500,000 right there. So when you see that and when you think of spending $60,000 to do something that's far more natural, which is catching water as it goes downhill instead of waiting for it to get to a river so you can pump it back uphill, it starts to make a lot of sense. It's a very sustainable solution, especially if the villagers learn to be, you know, to take conservation measures, to take care of the work, you know, to repair things, trenches and bunds that break down over time. It's not a huge investment.
Are any of these villages that have redeveloped their water systems able to preserve and capture enough of it to use that water as a commodity to sell to other places during the drought season?
You know, I didn't see that. I think that it's possible, but a lot of the water that goes into those tanker trucks comes out of bore wells, and a bore well is an environmentally ruinous well that goes down several hundred feet. It's usually tapping into some sort of aquifer as opposed to groundwater.
Mm-hmm.
So in general, I don't think anybody should be selling their water that way, or it shouldn't be coming out of any unirrigated area. So I didn't see that. It's interesting because the government of India has tried to regulate the drilling of these wells, and it quite unsuccessfully from what I could see. One day we visited in a small city in that region, we started looking for tanker trucks, and we found this little dirt lane where there were probably 12, 15 tanker trucks parked. And there were, along this lane, I think families that just happened to have good water supply. Families were basically operating these little enterprises out of there. They had 7 or 8 bore wells, which is very much against the law, and they were selling them to these tanker trucks. Village governments would then pay to have the tanker trucks come to the villages. And this was another sight to behold, because when a water tanker truck goes into a village and into cities, I mean, this is the other thing, is this, the water supply issue is not strictly a rural issue in India. I mean, Mumbai, India had a poor monsoon, a terribly poor monsoon this past summer, and Mumbai cut its water supplies by 30%. People were only given a couple of hours of water supply per day. So if you see a tanker truck arrive in a place where people need water, it is a mad, often violent scramble. People come running with jerry cans, and they are pushing and shoving. I had a couple of truck drivers tell me they've seen people injured. One person had seen somebody killed falling from the top of a truck. It really illustrates sort of the desperation that people feel trying to get that water.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Bob in Arlington. Hello, Bob.
Hello. Yeah, my question had to do with how we approach water usage. Water's got a lot more benefits and other uses in the environment other than just the use of man. You know, it's used to dilute and carry sediments and waste materials through the environment. Conservation will only go a little ways to solving some of our problems, and it really doesn't ever solve any problem. All conservation does is put off into the future the time when we face that, especially if we continue to grow and grow demand on the use of the water, put off the time when we'll have to face that water shortage. We need to really think about water not just from the perspective of man's utilization of water, but how the environment needs that water. Every time we put a dam in place, every time we take and put any kind of collection device in place where we collect water, we alter the natural environment out there. We need to live in harmony with it. And when you see these kinds of shortages, they're indicative that you've overextended the natural environment, not that we need to take and come in and do something to conserve the water and make the water go further, but we've got to take and look at what we're going to do ultimately with growth. I don't really have a question as much as a comment.
Well, thanks for your call. Do you want to respond to that, Sarah?
Sure. I think he's absolutely right, and I think that what we see happening in India is something that is meaningful. From an American perspective, India's population is growing rapidly, as we all know, but so is the world's population. Industrialization uses a lot of water. Even the sort of this micro-level capitalism that I was just describing, where somebody who has access to water takes an electric pump and, pumps it out of a deep aquifer, there's nothing sustainable about that use of water. The reason that I think that community-based watershed development is really important, and I think dovetails with what Bob is saying, is it's taking a natural process and, not moving water by truck. You're simply using the rainwater more efficiently. And so I think that that's one of the ways we can try to just redistribute a natural resource without overexploiting it in some places.
You mentioned earlier that terracing is one of the strategies that's used. We have an email here from Peter in Royce City who asks if you'd go into detail on the methods used to create the watershed, and also wanted to know, is there a rise in the groundwater table that lasts between monsoons?
Yeah, that's great questions. So watershed redevelopment, and I'm not an engineer, so somebody with a background in engineering could give you a far more detailed answer here, but it involves planting seedlings on ridgelines to bring back the greenery, terracing fields, installing a fairly sophisticated system of check dams and bunds. Basically, one of the ways that the organization describes it is they say, where the water is running, we teach it to walk. Where it is walking, we teach it to crawl. It's basically anytime water is running down a slope, having some sort of, disruptive structure that then causes the water to stop moving so quickly and to sink down into the ground. In terms of water tables rising in between monsoon seasons, yes, it was pretty profound in the villages I visited. And these were not people who were operating bore wells. These were people who were having shallow wells, you know, as they were only using groundwater. And they said it was up, 30 to 40% year to year. It didn't mean that they never ran dry, but after a good year, they were 30 to 40% higher the water levels than they would have been during an average year, which was pretty promising.
You mentioned earlier that everyone who lives in these villages is expected to contribute some free labor, but there's also a system by which some people can earn some salary for the work that they put in. Can you talk about that?
Yes. People who work on the watershed, again, because there is an overhead cost, you know, this is not a program that is entirely free. The NGO provides funds to the Village Watershed Development Council. So it's not outsiders coming in, and they give the money to the village, and then the village then decides how to use the money. But the money goes toward completing the watershed work. And so about 20 to 30% of the labor is free. Is voluntary, and then villagers are paid for their time otherwise. And so, for example, if you work 5 days, you're paid for four. If you work for, 10 days, you're paid for eight. And so it also does a lot for a village. It was keeping people in Satitiwati from migrating to the sugarcane fields. It was keeping them in the village for the duration of the watershed project. And then hopefully that the idea was that as the lands became more productive, they wouldn't have to migrate and the watershed work was completed. You know, once that revenue stream had dried up, they would be getting full-time income off of their farmlands.
My understanding is that the caste system in India is sort of officially no longer permitted, but unofficially alive and well, particularly in a lot of remote rural areas. Can you talk about how this program helps to challenge some of those old assumptions?
Sure. I was really amazed by that. You think that there are laws in place that are outlawing the caste system, but it's not the case at all. Even informally, it played a real role in day-to-day life in many of the villages I visited. Even inside of the tribal cultures, I focused on this one tribal village. There were castes inside of that, or there were different perceptions of who was worthy and who wasn't. But when the Watershed Organization Trust comes into these villages, they say everybody needs to be represented. So that means if a family owns land, if a family doesn't own land, members of all castes, members of all any grouping, any division. If there are people who have been disrespected in the village, well, they're now sitting at the table with an equal say in what goes on. And I think it was making a difference. I don't think it would be very simplistic to say that kind of does away with centuries of kind of hierarchies and bigotry, and that's not the case. But it did give everybody a voice and everybody voting power, and that I think slowly was bringing about change in the villages I saw.
Let's go next on the phones to John in Fort Worth. Hello, John.
Hi. I was just came in at the end of this conversation, but I thought of some of the ideas. They would be the same engineering that the Romans used to move water and save water in their aqueducts. And one thing in city in New York, they get their water from Ice Age Mountain lakes 80, 90 miles away. And the engineering things for conserving water and moving water, they're not that complicated. They're just something you have to do, and I just wanted to share that.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah.
I guess, can you talk, Sarah, about the challenges to scaling this? I suppose because a village is required to put in so much effort, that it's not something that we can assume can be quickly applied to places throughout India and other parts of the world.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think that the effects, when it's done well, are so profound that that they're pretty interesting. So, for example, in the regions of Maharashtra where I was visiting, it was almost contagious because I would go, like, for example, there's a village right next to Satishiwadi, and they were starting to see, you know, people pay attention to other people's business, and, you know, especially with the force of migration in the agricultural community in India, the people who have water have money and have productive farms. And so they then have to hire people, migrant laborers, to work on their farms. So the migrant laborers start to see these villages that have done something, you know, have brought back their watershed, and they start asking questions. Well, how did you do this? Who helped you do this? How do we do this? And in a way, I think it's kind of contagious. You know, there's success is incredibly compelling, especially to people who don't have a lot of options otherwise. And so, for example, in this village of Dharawadi, where the women had banned the sale of alcohol, one of the things they said is, oh, nobody, we used to all migrate to this one village and work on their farms, and they never treated us well. But now they all come here. They've ruined their area. They've overfarmed it. They haven't taken care of their resources. And now, you know, we try to treat them well, and we try to show them how they could bring their own village back. So I think it is fairly scalable. And there are projects going on all across India. WATER, the organization that I follow, WOTR, works in about 200 villages in India. But they also provide training for people who want to do similar programs through other entities. And it really is starting to happen across India. In some ways, it doesn't look good everywhere. You know, there are plenty of failed watershed redevelopment efforts, but I think that the research is beginning to show that the more you involve the community, the more sweat labor goes into it, the more successful and sustainable they tend to be. And so I think that there's a new movement afoot there to try to do watershed redevelopment a certain way, as John, the last caller, said. You know,
I'm so sorry that we're out of time. Sarah Corbett's new article is called A Harvest of Water. It's in the current issue of National Geographic. It really has been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.